This is WJBC This Week.
He had no remorse from the time of the trial until now. He had no remorse whatsoever.
Raising the minimum wage in conjunction with improving the overall jobs climate will make Illinois more competitive and create a booming economy.
We don't really help the people we say we're trying to help by lessening their opportunity.
Let's not let the pursuit of perfect be the enemy of what is possible today, what is good today, and what is right.
Some of the loose comments they've made about these measles vaccination just make the situation worse. It is a safe vaccine.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we recap the top news stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stahn. On this week's program, a Bloomington woman was chosen to help promote NASA's latest mission through social media. A local literary expert reacts to news of a sequel to the classic To Kill a Mockingbird. A longtime volunteer and public servant is honored, along with a number of local businesses. Congressman Aaron Schock discusses his recent trip to see the Pope in Rome. And an ex-ISU baseball coach reacts to the news of Redbird Hall of Famer Dave Bergman's death. That and more coming up this WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. There was big news in the world of literature this week as we learned that author Harper Lee, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning To Kill a Mockingbird, has plans to release a sequel to one of America's most loved novels more than a half century later. Jan Susina teaches adolescent literature at Illinois State University, and To Kill a Mockingbird is one of the class's signature study pieces. He talked to WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Why do you particularly love this book and love teaching this book? Because there have been many teachers over the years who have said we all need to read it and that it's one of the greatest literary creations of all time. But why do you personally love it?
It's a powerful book. It talks about race in America. It's beautifully written. Also, I grew up in Alabama, and it's set in South Alabama, so I kind of like that as well.
When you're meeting the students in your class, have some, all, none of them read To Kill a Mockingbird?
It's one of the more widely taught books in high school. And, I mean, it's sold over 40 million copies. And so many of the students and the students who take my course are planning to be high school teachers. For many of them, it's their favorite book.
Now, what is it, though, about the way Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird that makes it so much better than, let's say, a James Patterson book or the Bible or any other, you know, creation that people consider a literary masterpiece?
Well, she worked very hard on this. It's her one novel, and that's why everyone's thrilled about this second book. And, I mean, it's carefully plotted. It's seen through the eyes of a 9-year-old girl, a scout, who is in some ways a version of Harper Lee herself.
It was true that she almost lived this story. I mean, her father was a lawyer and was defending those who were accused of crimes in the South, and all of these subject matters came up. Why do you think her editor decided to change the viewpoint? Because from what I understand, if you've missed the story, ladies and gentlemen, To Kill a Mockingbird's sequel, Ghost Set a Watchman, which is coming out in July of 2015, was just announced. And from what I understand, this book was actually written before To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes. I think it's complicated. Harper Lee was a first-time author. Her editor at Lippincott asked her to make some changes. The editor thought the book should be set in the present as opposed to the past, and so it's told through the young scout. And this sequel, or the book that's coming out in July, it takes place 20 years later, but it's where the grown-up scout comes back to Macon, her hometown, and talks to her father, Atticus.
Is it at all possible that Harper Lee's wildest fears are going to come true? She has said multiple times she didn't end up publishing anything else after To Kill a Mockingbird because she was fearing the reaction from the public saying, well, it's not as good as your Pulitzer Prize-winning book. You're obviously a one-hit wonder. She was insecure about that reaction. Is it possible that that reaction could still come?
I think it's very complicated. I think many people's first response is just absolute delight. This is sort of like just discovering King Tut's tomb, that there's a second book out there. Then almost following that is it going to be as good as the first book?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is a question, and I think why that is a question is this book was actually written before To Kill a Mockingbird, and it's kind of interesting that the title, Ghost Set a Watchman, was actually the working title for the book that became To Kill a Mockingbird. And so she went through multiple drafts of To Kill a Mockingbird. First it was Go Set a Watchman, then it was changed to Atticus, you know, the central character, her father, and then eventually To Kill a Mockingbird. So it was a book that she was working on in 1957, and again, as a beginning author whose book was helped shape by an editor, this book may not be as wonderful as To Kill a Mockingbird, but nevertheless, people who love To Kill a Mockingbird, and there are lots of them, will want to know what happened to these characters, and she revisits the characters, and because it's written by Harper Lee, I'm sure it's going to be great, but whether it will be as wonderful as To Kill a Mockingbird, well, I can't wait to find out.
We're talking with Jan Cecina, who's an ISU professor of adolescent literature, has been teaching this book for many, many years. Is there any opinion of if To Kill a Mockingbird had come out now, if it would still be as revered, or is it because there was less competition in the literary world when Harper Lee published this book that people found it?
Right. To Kill a Mockingbird came out in 1960, won a Pulitzer Prize. It came out at exactly the right time. And it's a very savvy book because Harper Lee sets the book in the past. We're told it's taking place in 1935. And it kind of has this double vision of looking at the world. It's talking about race relationships in the South in the 1930s, but the immediate readership is the 1960s, which is really the hotbed of the civil rights movement in the South, in the entire United States. So she kind of can talk about the past and also be referencing the future.
So it's the perfect publication storm.
Yeah, and in some ways, her book is somewhat dated in terms of race relationships, and there have been some critics who have criticized it because in some ways Atticus is the white lawyer who defends the African-American, and the African-Americans are somewhat helpless. And I think one of the things that is true that is not completely addressed by Harper Lee is that you had, particularly in the South, the rise of African-American citizens who were pivotal in the civil rights movement. In fact, this new book is going to be set around 1955, 20 years later, and Rosa Parks in Montgomery, Alabama, starts the bus boycott. And so there are many pivotal people like Martin Luther King who are the counterparts of, say, the white lawyers like Atticus Finch.
Do you believe you will start teaching this new book, even though you haven't read it yet? By time it comes out, you'll be preparing for fall classes. Will this now become required reading, too?
You know, I first want to read it and see what it's like. It's going to be hard to replace To Kill a Mockingbird. In some ways, it is just such a wonderfully written book. I mean, she has a wonderful ear for language. It's funny. It's a coming-of-age story, and both the community matures and certainly the three children, you know, Scout, Jem, and Dill, who was Harper Lee's best friend, Truman Capote, who grew up in this small town in Alabama as well.
That was ISU professor Jan Cecina with our Susan Saunders. Longtime Normal Town Councilwoman Sonia Reese was recently presented with the McLean County Chamber of Commerce's Legacy of Excellence Award, this at the Chamber's annual gala. Chamber Director Charlie Moore joined Reese and WJBC's Tim Lewis this week to discuss how to make a difference and to honor those businesses who have done just that.
One of the messages that I try to leave with people who say they have some interest but they don't know what to do, and I say, just show up. Show up when something is being discussed or presented. Be involved. I know tomorrow evening there'll be a group that's meeting to talk about the next plan that will roll out for the town of Normal. It's a public meeting. So if somebody wants to get involved, come to the meeting. Just show up. And you'd be surprised how many opportunities come along to share your ideas.
Mm-hmm. If nothing else, to be informed.
To be informed.
All right.
Then you can decide, did I like being involved in that? Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. But you'll get a feel for it.
Sure. Absolutely. When people, when businesses elect to come here, what's the number one thing that they say? Obviously, we're probably the right size community for a lot of businesses to want to be here. But really, in reality, why do they? What's the number one thing you hear from new businesses, new big and small, and the reasons they want to relocate or build here?
There are a number of reasons. Depending on what is the business they're in, some of them like it because we're at such a crossroads. We're a crossroads of mm-hmm. the interstate system, so they can move quickly. They like it because there's a high quality of life, especially if it's a company that tends to bring in people with families. This is a town that embraces families. We have good education. They like that. We now have broadband services, fiber optics that we're trying to parlay into getting businesses interested in coming for those reasons. So a myriad of things gets business interested. But our local businesses, frankly, are our best avenue for growth. If you already got a business here, helping them expand, touch a new area is a lot easier than going outside and introducing a brand new company.
Absolutely. You know, and as a chamber, that's one of the things that we try to put some focus on is that, you know, far too often we ride the wave and you just go with the flow. But sometimes you have to remember to stick your hand out and shake a hand and thank someone for their investment. These business owners put down hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars of their own money invested in real estate, invested in their people, invested in their product, invested in their training. And we need to remember that. And not only, number one, thank them for that investment and making that investment here, as I've mentioned on the show before, the world is a keystroke away. So what is it that maintains or retains our workforce and our businesses here? But also then how do we encourage them? How do we provide resources for them to consider growing? How do we help them find those additional employees, look at those additional product lines, different real estate to grow the actual square footage that they need? Because it certainly is, I'll use the word easier and very lightly, to help a business grow than it is to have perhaps go out and attract a whole new business or start a new business up. We certainly want to be very cognizant of thanking the businesses that are investing with us and making sure that we can help them grow. And another way we do that, as a kind of parlay to the next part, is the five other excellence awards that we're able to honor on Saturday night. And really taking a look at what these businesses are doing, again, not just for themselves, but for the community, for the people they work with, for the people they work for their civic engagement, for their servant leadership, and their philanthropic efforts. And so with that, you know, there are five other excellent awards that we handed out. The first was to our Illinois Heart and Lung Foundation as a nonprofit agency excellence award. The amount of work that these people do, Kathy, at the director of the Illinois Heart and Lung Foundation, the amount of work they do with the defibrillators, and the people just don't know. They're unsung heroes mm-hmm. for what they do in our community. And I know Sonia has a good working relationship. Anything you want to say about the foundation?
Oh, my goodness. They train people. They put the defibrillators in many locations, and they make sure that people know how to use them. They're a group of cardiologists and pulmonologists, and they go way beyond their world of taking care of patients and trying to prevent things. So, yeah, we're pleased. They're part of our advocate system. In my other life, I work for Advocate Broman, and mm-hmm. so I get to see that.
Yes.
And I'm also with the town of Normal, and so they're located there.
Okay. The other recipient of Green Excellence Award, Home Sweet Home Ministries.
Yes.
The amount of effort that they do from recycling. And again, people don't, they might think of them for serving different populations in the community, whether it be through clothing and food and shelter. But what they do for the recycling efforts and the green initiatives that they do with even different canisters around the community where you can take your recyclables and leave them and taking them even down to their shop, their retail shop, and the initiatives that they are driving every day. And Marianne Poland, who's their CEO, the amount of work that she does and Matt on their staff who really focus on the green initiatives within the community. So we certainly wanted to reach up and lift them up for their Green Excellence Awards. Microbusiness. And so the business efforts, just thrilled to announce Kelly's Bakery as our Micro Business Excellence Award. Kelly and Jamie Matthey, since I've been in the community just over 6 years, are some of the first people that I met. Welcome you into Kelly's Cafe with a fantastic menu, and I'm going to put a plug in for their butternut squash. I haven't found any anywhere else, and freeze it, and I'll come down and get it later. But no, the amount of work that not only in downtown Bloomington that they focus on, but just giving back to the community in a number of different ways. And if you follow them on Facebook or you look at Twitter and take a look at all the different activities, nonprofit organizations, philanthropic giving. She's also a school teacher by day. Jamie has another business on the side as well. And so they're very entrepreneurial, involved with McLean County and Bloomington in specific, but really also giving themselves and just tremendously fantastic people. And so we were pleased to lift up Kelly's Bakery and Cafe as our micro business. Our small business, CM Promotions, Connie Mandula. They've been in town for a number of years and are involved with the advertising specialty business. And they, in their philanthropic efforts and all the nonprofits that their team as a staff participate in throughout the community and not just participate but lead and drive and chair and get involved with. And so we're so pleased to lift up CM Promotions as our small business. And our large business, one that the Chamber's done work with, the Town of Normal's done work with, Advocate Broman's done work with, a lot of us have done work with, is the Farnsworth Group. And the amount of work that they do, they've had a large presence in Bloomington Normal for a very long time. They've expanded across the nation and they do work worldwide. But the work that they give back through their employees, time, talent, and treasures to Bloomington Normal and throughout McLean County is almost just impossible to add up. So we are so thankful to lift up the Farnsworth Group as our large business.
Architects and engineers.
Yes.
And they provide it all. So if you're wanting to do a project, you can call on them. They'll help you with the planning. They'll design it. They'll help you guide right through the construction part, too.
But again, all these businesses are, along with Sonia, it's just an opportunity for the chamber. Kind of a phrase I learned a long time ago when I was in the Northwest Market was, in a large corporation, they used to say, if you can't pay them, plaque them. And 6 years ago, when I came down here, we just weren't plaquing anyone. We weren't paying attention to those who are really doing the good stuff. And for us, this is an exciting time to be able to lift them up in front of the community, a room of 600 community leaders and business leaders and municipalities and county government and elected officials. Congressman Schock was present with us that evening to really talk about the good things that are happening here, because it's easy to get caught up in all the bad things. You listen to, I know I'm on a radio station, but you listen to media, you read the papers, you get a lot of doom and gloom. We have so much to celebrate here. We have so much to be thankful for. And at times, it's good to just take a look and focus on what's right. What are we doing well? There's so easy to talk about what's wrong, especially when you start talking about the state or start talking about finances. And for a night, we get to turn that to the side just a bit and really focus on what are we doing well? How are we excelling? What are we achieving? And for that, it makes it a great evening to celebrate.
That was Normal Town Councilwoman Sonia Reese and McLean County Chamber of Commerce Director Charlie Moore with our Tim Lewis. Congressman Aaron Schock recently returned from a trip to Rome, where he had a private audience with Pope Francis. He talked about the trip with the WJBC's Adam Stasinski this week.
What was it that brought you to Rome in the first place?
Well, it's the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and the ending of the Holocaust, and it was a commemorative concert organized by a local constituent of mine in the 18th District. His mother, who is Italian and lives in Rome, organized a concert of music pieces that were written and performed in the concentration camps during the Holocaust. Many of the survivors perished, but their loved ones saved the music. Some of the survivors of the Holocaust were present in the audience, and their children, and in some cases grandchildren, sang or played the piano or were in the orchestra of the pieces that they had written. So it was a very emotional night where, you know, some very interesting stories were told about the music pieces before they were performed. And it was attended by a lot of dignitaries in Europe. The president of Italy was there, in addition to Pope Francis and other elected officials.
And can you talk a little bit about why it's so important that we continue to commemorate events like the liberation of Auschwitz and the Holocaust?
Well, you know, I think 4 million people perishing is something always to commemorate and memorialize. And it's shocking to think that this was only 70 years ago that this happened. It's shocking to think that millions of people were senselessly murdered, and so few people spoke up early on until the Allied forces led by the United States really stepped in. So it's not only about commemorating the lives that were lost, but also the old adage, if you don't learn history, you're destined to repeat it. You know, it's incumbent upon America to understand our role in the world, the force for good that we are currently and that historically we always have been. And when people cry out for help, regardless of where they are in the world, it's always the United States of America that they look to. And we can thank the United States and the Allied forces for ending the Holocaust and stopping the senseless murders that were going on. So, you know, it's obviously a dark time in human history, but, you know, we need to remember it for those that survived even today. There are people that, you know, certainly are older than 70 years old that were in those concentration camps, those that lost loved ones, and it's very meaningful for them every year when we do the what they call the Day of Remembrance, which is the end of the Holocaust.
Now, getting to your actual meeting with Pope Francis, what was it that you two were able to discuss?
We talked about a number of things. One, of course, is you know, his belief in the value of life. This was relevant because we were celebrating the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and the end of the Holocaust and all the senseless killings that occurred during the Holocaust, and how whether someone is Jewish or Muslim or Christian, we as Christian people need to speak out in support of those lives, and obviously that goes for all stages of life, whether it's a life that's old or whether it's an unborn child. The importance of the sanctity of that life, and the importance on making sure the rule of law and we as a people speak out for those that can't speak for themselves.
This is a pope that has really been striking a chord, from what I can tell, with people across lots of different religions across the world. So when you sit down and you meet with the Pope one-on-one, what's your impression of him?
Extremely down-to-earth, charming, personable, and has a good self-awareness about who he is. It's obvious that he's a bit uncomfortable with all the pomp and circumstance that surrounds him. And he made a few jokes with us about his protocol officers and how stringent they are with him. And, you know, he clearly knows he has a role to play, but I think as a former Franciscan priest, he's definitely not used to living in a place as awe-inspiring as the Vatican.
So obviously, being a congressman, you certainly have the chance to meet a lot of important people, but when you meet someone like the Pope, do you get starstruck at all?
No, not really. I mean, I guess one of the benefits of being in Congress is there's a lot of dignitaries that come through Washington, D.C. you have the chance to meet, but Pope Francis is someone I have enormous respect for. He's refocused the church's efforts on the care for the poor and reaching out and caring for those who may not be as comfortable as the rest of us, and I think that's the role of the church. You know, he's really been willing to talk about some tough issues as the titular head of the Catholic Church.
That was Congressman Aaron Schock with our Adam Stasinski. Today's local news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. NASA is trying to generate buzz about its latest mission by enlisting people who know how to generate buzz. Katie Eads of Bloomington, who works in social media for Country Financial, was chosen along with several dozen others to join the NASA social team to get a behind-the-scenes look at the satellite that launched this week to study soil moisture. Katie talked about her experience with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
The acronym for this is SMAP.
Yes.
And what is that short for?
Soil Moisture Active Passive.
Soil Moisture Active Passive,
yes.
Or SMAP.
Yes.
I said not a very good acronym, but you say...
Oh, SMAP makes for a fun hashtag.
There you go.
See, and that's what it's all about. So you
SMAP.
May be wondering,
why?
I wondered, why would NASA have a person from Country Financial there watching this launch? And so what is the interest?
So the interest is that, you know, they want to get people who are passionate about the things that NASA is doing, but also people who are curious, who are on social media, and who this information would apply to. And I think that's a part of why last month I filled out an application with the NASA social program, and they had over 300 people from, I think it was 42 different countries that applied. So we had people from the UK, we had people from Canada, and they invited people out. They said they would select up to 70. I believe there were 52 there, counting myself. And we were on talking about it on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, blogging, videography. They also did a live broadcast for the mission on NASA TV. So I got to ask a question and be on there, and it was a very cool experience.
So who is following all this on social media?
People who weren't there but are very interested in the things that NASA is doing, but also people, I mean, the information they're going to gather is going to impact literally everyone, because anytime we have more information about weather, where they're able to better forecast the weather, it's going to make everyone safer if there are going to be big storms or floods or anything like that. And also the farmers as well. There were people there for the NASA TV broadcast from the USDA. They were talking about the information as well, that how it would be used to help. I mean, there was over a $30 billion loss with droughts last year because of that.
What was the question that you asked during the news conference of the live broadcast on NASA TV?
Yeah, so if you watch the broadcast, I think it's around the 16-minute mark where you see me with the mic asking the question. But I basically said, how will this information help our farmers? Because there was a $30 billion loss due to droughts last year. And they basically said that, you know, anytime there's more information, the better it is, right? You know, you can't, this information isn't going to say, well, let's just move all the water to where it needs to be. But anytime they have more information, they're able to use that. And I mean, farming's come a long way, and there's technology that's used so heavily to help with crop productivity.
The naysayers are going to go, well, we know there's drought and no moisture in the soil in parts of California.
Exactly.
Do we need a satellite to tell us
but
that?
But I would imagine, too, that it can help American farmers predict, and it could direct the markets if, say, you know, we know that South America's soil moisture is, you know, is rich right now, and it looks like that'll affect their crops, and then obviously global markets are affected.
And I do want to say, I'm not an expert in this, but I'm just relaying the things that I learned. And they talked about, you know, it's one of those things, like, especially with flooding, you know, if you know that the soil is particularly dry, the 30 days before, you know that it's not as likely to flood. Or if it has rained heavily and there's a lot of moisture there, chances are it will flood. Again, not an expert, but this is what I learned.
So did you have a personal interest in, you know, having an experience with NASA? I mean, how did this opportunity come about? You mentioned that you applied.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Country saying this would be good for you to do, or Katie Eade saying, I'd like to do this?
It was me. I follow some of the NASA pages on Facebook, and I happened to be scrolling through my phone on Facebook, and I saw the mention of the NASA social program. I had no idea about it until I saw it on my phone. And I thought, oh, well, this will never happen. Let's just fill out the application, spend a couple minutes on it. A few weeks later, I got an email that I was on the wait list. And I said, well, that's fantastic. Let me give you a little more information. And I'm kind of a geek. I grew up in 4-H and FFA, small town of 200, farming community.
What town?
Heddick, Illinois. It's a couple hours south of here. 200 people. It's not many people know.
Not familiar with it, yeah.
So I filled out the application. They emailed me and said, hey, you know, you're on the wait list. And I'm like, great, here's some other information that I, you know, didn't do a thorough job on the application. And then about 2.5-3 weeks before the actual launch, they emailed me. I like to say, you know, NASA emailed me and said, congratulations, come on out. We'd love to have you here. And so that's kind of how it happened.
So was it what you expected?
It was. I am sad that I missed the launch. I'm really sad about that because I was wanting to experience it. One of the really cool things is that Wednesday, I got access to the Air Force base. I have like a piece of paper that says I had special access. And in the email that they sent, they said, there are people who work here that do not get access to the places you're getting access to. We took a tour of the command center. Couldn't take photos, of course, for security purposes. But we were in the command center. And then that night we went and watched the tower roll back, which is where the satellite is there. And they roll back all the kind of almost scaffolding in a way, I guess. They roll all that back so that the satellite and the rocket is ready to launch. And Charlie Bolden, who is the administrator for NASA, he's presidential appointee, basically the CEO, if you were to think of it that way. And he came out and he was talking to us. And it was really exciting because that was the day of the anniversary of the Challenger. Happened with that. And so he was in D.C. that morning laying a wreath for that. And then he was out that evening out in Lompoc, California at Vandenberg Air Force Base. And he was talking to us, you know, as we see the everything that's happening and hear the call signals. And, you know, basically he said, you know, if you're excited, be excited. If you cry, cry and talk about that. What we want you to do is come out and, you know, experience this. Don't be taking photos. Don't be taking videos because you'll be able to find those on YouTube and online. Experience it. You know, just take it all in and tell people about your experience and share your experience. And so that was really cool.
And then it didn't happen.
Exactly. It didn't happen.
They set them all up and it didn't happen. So you came home. I'm sure. Did you watch it live on the internet?
I watched it on my phone, which just goes to show how far technology has come in recent years. I watched the launch of a rocket go off while on my phone back in Illinois.
Live.
Yeah.
Did you get new followers for the country Twitter and Facebook page?
Yeah, and I had – part of it was that they want you to do it on your personal social. So I did it on there, and then we shared and retweeted some of that on Country Financial, too.
That was Katie Eads of Country Financial with Scott and Colleen. Illinois State University lost one of its sports legends this week. Dave Bergman, who was an All-American at ISU, who went on to play 17 seasons in the major leagues and won a World Series with the Detroit Tigers, died Monday at age 61 after a three-year battle with cancer. Bergman was good friends with Jim Brownlee, who joined the ISU coaching staff shortly after Bergman had graduated. And Brownlee shared some stories about the ISU Hall of Famer with the WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Not only was he a really decent hitter, he was a solid baseball player. I mean, he understood the game. He was a very good defensive player, too, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. If he was right-handed, he would have been a shortstop for a long time. But he was left-handed, batted left, and could really run. He was a great athlete. And when he was at ISU, you know, in his junior year where he's eligible for the draft, you'd be at the games and there'd be six or seven scouts to see him. And, you know, he was taken in the second round by the Yankees. That's how good he was. But the scouts would not pay any attention to the other eight hitters from ISU. It was pretty sad. But as soon as Bergman would come up to bat, I don't care what inning it was or whatever, all the stopwatches would come out, and, you know, he could hit for power, played first base, played the outfield, and did both in the big league. So he had a great career, 17 years. There's not many guys that can say that.
What kind of kid was he?
He was a fierce competitor. And, you know, he was kind of quiet, but he was one of those guys, when he talked, you listened. And it was interesting. I came back to teach at UI in 1972, and I actually played on a flag football team with Dave Bergman at ISU for intramurals because I was on the faculty so you could play, and it was a lot of fun. But he was a great person, you know, and he after his playing days, he lives in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and he is really developed within the community, Dan, and he started Grosse Pointe Redbird baseball. You know, he loved the Redbirds and was very proud and did a lot of things. Once he got established in the big leagues, he actually put the fence out up at Duffy Bass Field, the one that's out there right now. He paid for that himself. He was always willing to give back to the program and was highly involved all the time with ISU baseball.
Well, there's no doubt that he certainly deserved to have his number retired. He's only one of two players that have had their numbers retired for ISU.
Right. He was the time that he was here playing, Dan, was when ISU was making the move, as you know, from, you know, collegiate division, which was called at that time, which was basically Division II, to Division I, to the university division. And Dave was Coach Bass's first big-time recruit. And, you know, the Redbirds were really good through the 60s, but then when they moved up to the Missouri Valley and it was a little different level, Dave was his first big recruit that he got to establish things through the mid-70s. And there was no doubt in your mind he was going to make it in the big leagues, and I think he played for four different teams, you know, the Yankees. I can't remember. I don't think he ever made it to the bigs with the Yankees, but then he went, you know, he went to Houston and played for a long time, and then he was with the Giants and then ended up with the Tigers for about 9 years.
He had a great career. When he was at Illinois State, and you said that he was kind of a lead by example, he wasn't a real vocal person. I think that would have been an interesting combination to have him playing for a coach like Duffy Bass, who was maybe just the opposite of that, wasn't he?
Yeah, they were like oil and water, you know, and David was not afraid to say what he thought, you know, if he was going to disagree. And, you know, sometimes that is a healthy situation. But, you know, he was obviously the captain and two-time All-American, and I still think he's the highest drafted professional player to come out of Illinois State as a baseball player. He's a second-round guy. And, you know, it was a great time to be at Illinois State. We had Doug Collins. We had Dave Berkman. We had D.A. Wybring. Dan Rohn was here. And, you know, ISU was not as big then as it is now, and everybody was really involved in the other sports. We all kind of lived together, and it was a great time, and it was a good run in ISU athletics with Milt White Specker, you know, the lead guy, and it was a fun time, and Dave was a big part of that.
We're talking with former ISU coach Jim Brownlee, who coached, played flag football against, and was a friend of Dave Berkman, who's passed away yesterday. When was the last time you saw or talked to Dave?
The last time I saw Dave was 5 years ago on a recruiting trip to Michigan, and that was the last time that I saw him. So it's been a while, and of course he's been battling this cancer for about 3 years, and you know, it really took its toll on him and his family, and it was very unfortunate. You know, he's in a better place today, and there'll be a lot of good stories told about Dave Berkman here in the next week or so. So he was a good friend to a lot of people.
That was retired ISU baseball coach Jim Brownlee with Dan Sweeney. The weekend news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the weekend news. A Bloomington man will see up to 55 years in prison for shooting another man to death in May of 2013. 29-year-old Michael Mays was sentenced Friday on charges of first-degree murder in the death of Aaron Robinson. Aaron's mother, Karen Robinson, says Mays should see more time behind bars.
He took my son's life. I think he should have had life, which by the time he get out, it's going to be most of his life anyway. But he had no remorse from the time of the trial until now. He had no remorse whatsoever.
Mays shot Robinson after a series of altercations on May 13, 2013. Mays contends Robinson was the aggressor. A top aide to Congressman Aaron Schock has resigned following reports that he posted racially charged comments on social media. Here's Westwood One political correspondent Athena Jones.
Benjamin Cole, who was a senior advisor for Congressman Schock, and he made a series of posts over the course of several years, some of which included videos he was taking of his neighborhood.
In one of the posts published by thinkprogress.org, a liberal website, Cole compared African Americans to animals from the National Zoo, which was closed at the time of the post due to the government shutdown in 2013. Earlier in the week, Cole tried to stop a Washington Post reporter from taking photos of Schock's congressional office, which is decorated in a style modeled after the TV show Downton Abbey. The Watchdog Group has requested an ethics inquiry over the interior design work. A future vision of Uptown Normal is starting to take shape. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports the public was given an update of the project being called Uptown 2.0.
Consultants have developed three concepts, all of which have different placements for the Normal Public Library. Consultant Doug Farr says one concept puts the library on the north of the railroad tracks on Constitution Boulevard.
It's large enough for the library, a three-story library. It adds a lot of, obviously, foot traffic to Constitution Boulevard. The library estimates that about 1,000 people a day visit the library on average.
Farr says all three concepts involve a pedestrian crossing for the railroad tracks, along with switching College Avenue and Mulberry Street from one-way to two-way roads. Another public meeting with updated designs will be held in about 30 days. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And the Salvation Army in McLean County is celebrating this week after surpassing its Make a Difference campaign goal. More than $515,000 was brought in through community donations to the Red Kettles and mail appeal. Director of Development Angie Fulton says they beat their goal by $45,000.
We're just thrilled that we were able to do this. Especially going into the last week of Kettles, we were kind of behind where we wanted to be, and I think the community just really stepped up to support us.
Fulton says this will go a long way in helping the Salvation Army reach its overall yearly fundraising goal of $1.4 million. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. Bloomington's City Council meets on Monday night, while Advocate Broman will officially rededicate its family health clinic expansion on Wednesday. Unit 5 of District 87 also have regular meetings on Wednesday night. And on Friday, the 1 Billion Rising Global Campaign to stand up against domestic violence against women and girls will come to Heartland Community College for a noon observance. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.